If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow, Hillary?
Yeah.
Was sitting here?
Why were you? What were you watching in your dressing room?
I was playing Sega Genesis.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, you'll hear Seth's interview with Hillary Rodham Clinton, recorded on the anniversary of the 2016 election. Then, Seth talks to Will Ferrell, who also takes a few more questions backstage exclusively for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
Last night saw the first major elections of the Trump era, and Democrats won big, trouncing Republicans in New Jersey and Virginia. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. That's right. Democrats had major victories in the governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia last night, which means it's cool to be a Democrat again. Right? New Jersey... Isn't that right, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy? Oh, my God. Democrats are such nerds. He looks like he just won a chess meet. But hey, at least New Jersey finally has a governor who can catch air. But Democrats can be forgiven a little awkward enthusiasm because they'd spent the last 2 weeks absolutely freaking out over the governor's race in Virginia, where it seemed like Republican Ed Gillespie was gaining ground on Democrat Ralph Northam by running a Trump-inspired race-baiting campaign. Pundits the day before the race were already gloomy, like this panel on Morning Joe, during which Mika Brzezinski could not contain her panic.
We're going to go around the table now.
Oh, no.
Election's tomorrow. Let me just start with this question.
I don't know.
Does anybody here think that the Democrats are going to win the governorship in Virginia tomorrow?
I don't know.
Does anybody think
and I'm
think?
Alarmed nope. that this is
no?
a question.
Ed what about you?
Gonna win.
I don't
what
think that? So. I think
and is it the Donna Brazile stuff? What is turning people the last second?
Do you think Ed Gillespie or Northam wins?
It doesn't look like Northam wins.
Oh, my God.
You gotta love how Mika sounds in that clip. Like she just heard some dirty gossip about a friend while holding a glass of Pinot Grigio. Oh my God! With the pool boy? So even before the results came in last night, Democrats were certain they didn't have a chance, which of course is how you know they actually had a chance. They won, but at least the Democrats were wrong again. In fact, Democrats romped to victory in several states, first in New Jersey, where Murphy, the Democrat, overwhelmingly won the race to replace GOP Governor Chris Christie. Christie is so unpopular in New Jersey that on Election Day, he found himself bickering with a voter on the street over a local issue, merging a township and a borough after he cast his ballot.
Anything else? Sure, ma'am. Why not?
Well, I live in Linden Township.
Yeah, why not?
The question to you is, why didn't you merge the borough and the township?
Because I can't.
In 8 years.
As governor, I can't.
So why didn't you?
I can't.
Well, then you're voting.
I understand. You're so frustrated. You know what? The easiest thing in the world, the easiest thing in the world is to stand where you stand and stand on the sidelines and critique. Run for the township committee, amend the township, and be the voice to do it. No, I know, because that's too hard. It's easier. It's easier to sit here. It's easier to sit here and complain. It's easier.
And I don't have the money like you.
Yeah, oh, really?
So
I'm sure. Easier to sit here and complain. But you know what? That's the joy of public service. It's serving folks like you that is really such a unique joy.
Man, it's nice that success hasn't changed Chris Christie. You know, The best thing about Christie living in New Jersey is knowing he'll never be able to go anywhere in public again without someone giving him Hey! Hey, Governor, I got a bridge right here. Let me raise it for you. There you go. There's another one over there. There you go. You can cross from New Jersey right over to go yourself. There you go. And that wasn't the only big result in New Jersey. There was also the case of a local Republican official named John Carman who mocked the Women's March in January with a Facebook meme that said, "Will the women's protest be over in time for them to cook dinner?" And that inspired first-time candidate Ashley Bennett to run against Carman, and last night, Bennett won. So now John Carman will be home in time to make dinner. Though he doesn't look like he'd nail it. Good news, honey, I made fire bread. Democrats also had big wins in Philadelphia, where a civil rights lawyer who defended Black Lives Matter activists just became district attorney, and in Maine, where voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure to expand Medicaid over the objections of their GOP governor, Paul LePage. LePage vetoed the Medicaid expansion 5 times and supported President Trump's attempts to repeal Obamacare. In fact, LePage made his name by telling voters he would fight Obama's agenda tooth and nail.
As your governor, you're going to be seeing a lot of me on the front page saying, "Governor LePage tells Obama to go to hell."
Well, last night, Maine voters told LePage, "You first." And let's not forget New York City, where the result, a win for Democratic Mayor Bill de Blasio, was essentially guaranteed. But there was an especially fun wrinkle in the fate of former Fox News pundit and Trump supporter Bo Dietl, who ran against de Blasio and has a history of making racist comments. Dietl got crushed last night, which might have had something to do with his closing message, a bizarre video of him dancing on the subway.
No curses in my verse, it didn't have time to rehearse it. We just came to uplift your vibe and scratch the surface. Go ahead, Bo, tell them what you know.
All I know, I love the street music. When I become mayor, there'll be more street music.
Man, you gotta love New Yorkers. They know the first rule of an asshole on a subway is ignore him and hope he goes away. And with Bo Dietl, it worked. Hey, I'm running for mayor. You guys want to watch my dance? And Dietl has not been handling his loss very well. This morning, he took to Twitter to attack the chairman of a third party that refused to endorse him, tweeting, "Good morning, Frank Morano. I lost last night, but I'm still a multimillionaire. You're still a fat loser in the Loser Reform Party. And you know you're the real loser when you can't even spell the word loser." But by far, the biggest rout was in Virginia, and even aside from the governor's race, Democrats had a huge night there. For example, a transgender woman named Danica Rome was elected to the Virginia State House, becoming the first transgender lawmaker in the country. And not only that, she beat a Republican incumbent, Bob Marshall, who sponsored a transgender bathroom bill, and once referred to himself as Virginia's chief homophobe. He also refused to debate Rome and referred to her with male pronouns. The best part of Rome's victory was her response when she was asked if she had anything to say about Marshall after she beat him. Rome said, "I don't attack my constituents. Bob is my constituent now." Damn. Damn. She threw so much shade, his face turned even whiter. Virginia's also elected the state's first 2 Latina lawmakers, and in a truly shocking result, a Marine veteran who calls himself a Democratic Socialist upset one of the most powerful Republicans in the Virginia House of Delegates. Republicans got beat so bad in Virginia, last night even the statue of Robert E. Lee was chased out of town. By apparently a very slow mob. And that's what's especially interesting about last night's results in Virginia, because Gillespie very much ran a Trump-inspired campaign that openly embraced Trump's racial grievance politics. He aired ads connecting Northam to the MS-13 gang in sanctuary cities, sent out mailers attacking kneeling NFL athletes, and made keeping up Virginia's Confederate statues a centerpiece of his campaign, with ads like this one.
For governor, there's a clear choice. Ralph Northam wants to take down Virginia's Civil War monuments.
I will do everything that I can to remove the statues at the state level.
Ralph Northam will take our statues down. Ed Gillespie will preserve them.
I'm for keeping them up, and he's for taking them down. And that's a big difference in November.
November of 1866? Trump, of course, enthusiastically embraced Gillespie's race-baiting campaign, tweeting that Northam is fighting for the violent MS-13 killer gangs in sanctuary cities and that Gillespie might even save our great statue's heritage. Well, you'll never guess how Trump feels about Gillespie now that he's lost. Last night, he tweeted, "Ed Gillespie worked hard, but did not embrace me or what I stand for." Don't worry, Ed. Trump's only upset because the election is still fresh. The good news is, in Virginia, when you lose, 150 years later, you get a statue. Of course, this is just one election night, and there's still a long way to go, but last night's results were promising for a Democratic Party in desperate need of something to give them hope. And if there's one thing Democrats are good at, it's celebrating victories. Scratch that. This has been A Closer Look. First Lady, Senator, Secretary of State, and the first woman to win the presidential nomination of a major American political party, Hillary Rodham Clinton, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. And you are here. It's an anniversary of sorts. So yes. I guess happy, unhappy anniversary.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. I was trying to think of where would I want to be on the one-year anniversary of what happened, and I thought, Seth.
Yeah.
I mean, it just sort of...
It just made sense.
It just came to me.
Well, I'm so happy you're here, but I want you to know I wish you were elsewhere.
So do I. I wish we were doing this out of a big White House.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking, coming into knowing you were coming, obviously there were elections last night.
Yes. Weren't that great?
Yeah.
That was terrific.
And... You know, there's an instant analysis, and I think if things had gone the other way, people would have said, oh, this continues the problem of the Democratic Party. Now there's a little bit of hope.
Yes.
Because there's a little bit of hope, I thought we'd have a drink and some champagne.
Oh! You know?
But I do want you to know I was prepared in case the election went the other way with some backup. But we don't need that. We'll put that away. So cheers.
Cheers.
And I want to speak to the fact that last night was a very... good night for women. What
yes.
is your reaction to that?
Oh, my gosh. I was thrilled. I mean, look, I think we're seeing the first
you
signs.
You put your champagne down.
Okay,
I feel like
thank
this
you.
Is.
Yeah.
You can have a sip first. I feel like I asked you a question before you had a sip.
That's all right.
Okay.
You know, I think the fever is finally breaking. I think that Americans, and as we saw last night, are saying, you know what? We really like our health care. We don't like hatred and bigotry. And we don't want to get shot wherever we go in our country. So I think there is a growing awareness that the only way to reverse this is actually to go out and vote for people who have your values and will stand up and fight for them. So last night was great on so many fronts, but what was really exciting were the number of women, particularly young women, who decided they were not going to be discouraged, they were going to get out there. And I know how scary that is. I mean, first time I ever ran for something, I was pretty terrified. And so I'm supporting a lot of these groups. I have this group called Onward Together, and we're supporting a lot of the groups that are recruiting and training and sending these young people, particularly young women, out. It was fabulous. You know, yesterday... one of the groups I support called Run for Something, usually if you're a first-time candidate, you have about a 10% chance of winning. 40% of their candidates won. Another group called Emerge America, they were so excited because 9 of the House of Delegate races in Virginia were women that they had helped train. I could go on and on. I won't. But just to say... we are on the right track if people will stay involved, if people will register to vote, if people will vote, and if people are willing to run. And that's the answer.
You talked a lot in your book about, you know, any candidate has to be resilient to
yes,
run, especially
right.
in this toxic political climate.
Right.
But yet women have to be even more resilient. Mm-hmm. And you're hoping for a day, or I think we are all to some degree longing for a day, where a woman, all they need to do if they run for office is be as resilient as
yes.
a man.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, there's that old comment that goes back years. You know we will have reached equality when a mediocre woman can win just like a mediocre man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that... You know, I don't say that as being, you know, in any way disrespectful. But
it's
women,
complimentary to some.
Well, women are held to such a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
And what has been really great to me, given the devastation of the loss, which obviously I write about in my book to some length and a lot of pain, is that, you know, still people love our country. They believe in our future. They want to be part of it, and they're willing to put themselves out there, knowing that they're going to get all kinds of criticism and attacks and all the rest of it. But if we have enough people doing that, it'll make a difference, because I think the best way to get sexism out of politics is to get more women into politics, and that will change the dynamic.
So, again, the narrative sort of changed with a successful night for the Democratic Party, but the DNC had a bad couple of weeks. Donna Brazile wrote a book. I know she's a longtime colleague of yours, and she sort of, in her book, made this comment that your campaign, through an agreement, had too much influence to maybe at the detriment of the Sanders campaign. She sort of walked back those comments now.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to that?
I didn't know what she was referring to, because, as has now come out, that just wasn't the case. But the current DNC leadership really invested heavily in Virginia and New Jersey and other places. And I called the current chairman, Tom Perez, to congratulate him, because he didn't get knocked off course. He didn't get overwhelmed by other narratives and stories coming at him. He said, okay, our job is to knock on doors, make phone calls, and turn out voters. And you know what? They did. And that's part of the reason we won.
You, at the same time, you mentioned the smaller organizations, the more grassroots.
Yes.
Well, I noticed on your Twitter feed last night, you were shouting out organizations like Indivisible and... Yes. And, you know, there's a lack of trust in the DNC, whether it's fair or not. There is a core lack of trust. And I think one of the things is it's so big. Is the future maybe these more small grassroots organizations that are a little bit more connected to the voters than maybe the DNC is?
I think it's both. I think it's not either or. You know, and I am working hard to support the current DNC leadership. They've got to make some big investments. You know, usually in a campaign, you see what's on TV, you see whatever the candidates are saying. But underneath that, there's so much work going on, like we saw in Virginia last night. It's really hard work. It's not glamorous work. And what the DNC is trying to do is rebuild our infrastructure, which we didn't have. And I think that's something that put us at a disadvantage. So they can do some things that nobody else can do. And we have to support them to do that. However, these new groups, these grassroots groups with lots of energy that I'm supporting as well, are so into it. And they're people often new to politics. A couple of them are people I've known a long time. Some I just met in the last 6 months. But everybody wants to play a part in helping Democrats and progressives get elected. So I think it's not either or. I think that would be a mistake. I think it's got to be, we got to really invest in helping to make the DNC the best it can be, and we've got to really support these grassroots groups that are springing up.
It's exciting to see a new way of doing things. I want to talk about something that's a little bit more depressing compared to last night's results, which is, you know, Donald Trump, President Trump at this point, has had very few, if any, legislative achievements, and those on the left will celebrate that, but there is a very scary thing that sometimes... But he's also, without needing to make a legislative achievement, he's degrading things such as the State Department where
yes,
you work.
That's
How
right.
worried should we be about the state of the State Department at a time when there's so much going on geopolitically?
Well, I think we should be worried about the state of the whole government, but I know the State Department well, having served there for 4 years. There is a lot of expertise there. You know, if you're trying to figure out what to do about North Korea, don't you think you'd want people who actually speak the language, know the history, and may have had some previous experience?
Well, no, because I have Wikipedia.
Yeah, well, yeah. And people whispering in your ears who have no basis even in Wikipedia. So I think that there is a sense of demoralization. People who I know, some of whom are still there, most of whom have now left, you know, really feel like the country is kind of going off in the wrong direction, because diplomacy is key to solving any of these contentious problems. And if you don't pay attention to the people who have a contribution to make, you're just kind of, you know, making it up as you go, then you're going to lose a lot of the expertise and experience that we've built up over generations. So I think it's a mistake. I regret it. And I think it makes us weaker. You know, I've negotiated with, I have met with, you know, many of the leaders who are still in office, who, you know, President Trump is now meeting with. They come fully briefed. They understand what's going on. They have analyzed our weaknesses. They try to go after us in ways that are sometimes subtle, but if you know enough, you can pick it up and then try to prevent it from becoming a problem. And he's just flying blind. And, and you know, he doesn't listen to people. He undercut his own Secretary of State about diplomacy on the North Korea problem. So I think it weakens us. I think it gives a lot of aid and comfort to these leaders of countries that are trying to, frankly, take advantage of us during this time when we don't seem to have a particular strategic understanding of our role in the world.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank
Always
you,
a pleasure to see you. Hillary Rodham Clinton, everybody. What Happened? It's available now.
Ryan Reese, audience member comedian for Late Night with Seth Meyers, here with Nava from California. President Trump began his 12-day tour in Asia earlier this week. What are your expectations for this trip?
Like, really, in terms of diplomacy, I'm just hoping he can have a full conversation with another world leader without saying something horribly offensive.
This week, the Paradise Papers were released and several members of President Trump's cabinet were mentioned in them with ties to Russia. How do you think this is going to affect their position and President Trump?
I think it's going to look most like what happened with Tom Price, and I think we're going to see some form of resignations that are also in the shape of firings, but I think we're going to have a lot of empty cabinet seats. Sadly, I don't think they're going to be filled with great first-class citizens. I think we're just going to keep getting the swamp, and it's going to keep being bad, but I think that'll be a trend for these next 4 years as more scandals get released. We somehow out the bad guy, but a worse guy is going to come
happens,
in.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know our guest from his work on Saturday Night Live and films such as Anchorman, Talladega Nights, and Step Brothers. He stars alongside Mark Wahlberg in Daddy's Home 2, which is in theaters Friday. Please welcome back to the show our very good friend Will Ferrell, everybody. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And I owe you extra thanks. We had you booked first, and then we actually had to ask you, would you be willing to be a second guest to Hillary Rodham Clinton? And you said, yeah.
I'm not the first guest?
No, Hillary Rodham Clinton was just out here, yeah.
Hillary, an impersonator?
No, we had the real Hillary, yeah.
Was on?
Yeah.
Just
right
ago.
Before you, yeah.
Why am I even out here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's still, you know, we can get across.
Oh. Wow, Hillary?
Yeah.
Was sitting here?
Why were you, what were you watching in your dressing room?
I was playing Sega Genesis.
The very old
Sega
We don't
Genesis.
Have one. Did you bring?
I have a pocket Sega
oh,
Genesis.
Oh, gotcha.
Bring
oh,
with
gosh,
me.
Yeah. Well, you missed Hillary Rodham Clinton.
I was so into
How'd you do? Were you doing well?
I was playing, what was I? I was playing Centipede. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. Wow.
Sega Genesis.
Oh, wow.
Oh, so I'm the second guest.
Yeah.
That's still good.
Yeah.
Because it's 1:18 in the morning.
Yeah. It's a little late now.
I couldn't figure out why it was so late.
Yeah, it's really late.
And I'm like, they'll knock on my door at some point.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Well, you say, like, time doesn't even
move. By the way,
move.
This is Sega Genesis. So, those at home, if you're just tuning on right at this moment, people will know. You might want to do a lower
one,
third.
A very small one. So yeah, we'll put Sega Genesis there. And then, hopefully, they'll send you some free stuff if we get a Sega. So, you shot Daddy's Home 2 in Boston.
I did.
And you were actually staying at the hotel when the Celtics were in the playoffs last year, every team that the Celtics played in the playoffs would come through.
Would stay at the Ritz-Carlton that I was staying at, and I would run into the players occasionally. One time I ran into some of the Washington Wizards, who then said, wait, you got to come with me. Took me into a room, which was two adjoining rooms, and was their impromptu training area.
Oh, they were playing basketball inside?
No. They were giving people massages. Not the players. The training staff.
Okay. This is getting very shady. Are you sure it was the Wizards? Are you sure these people played for a basketball team?
Yeah, the Wizards. They were six Asian guys. They called themselves the Wizards.
It was not. I think he walked into like a weird...
I was in the south end of Boston.
Okay, so you had walked out of the Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah, I was out of the...
Okay, yeah, I don't think that was a basketball team.
Okay, well, I did, however... okay, here's the true part of the story. This is the best part right here. So the teams would stay at this hotel because they also had it was connected to an Equinox gym. Hope I get an Equinox pass for that. Sega Genesis.
Sega Genesis.
Lifetime membership to Equinox.
Oh, lifetime. Yeah.
So they had a gym there, so the teams would stay in that hotel because they could do their pre-game workout.
Mm.
And the Cavaliers were there, and I'm, you know, lifting weights.
Yeah.
Using the universal weight system. Love to get some universal weights. And I see LeBron James.
All right, that's pretty good.
So yeah. I don't usually bother people. I kind of know Kevin Love a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So
UCLA,
I said hi to
right?
Kevin. UCLA, yeah. I said hi to him. And then I went over to LeBron. I'm like, I just have to say hello. How are you? And I just said, I was just telling my wife the other night that you need to run for president.
Mm.
You're from the Midwest.
Yep.
You're very famous. You're very popular. You're very articulate. Please run for office. So, LeBron.
Oh. Double down.
I'm telling you now, we need you. And I would love some of your shoes.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh. Can this be, you just have one genuine thing without it being about getting free stuff.
I've got four things coming my way. So, yeah.
I think at best you're going to get one or two.
Okay.
You had your kids on set. Yeah. 7, 10, 13?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Here's a photo of your kids. They're they're very adorable. And they were on set with you.
They were on set
I think
me
for that clip.
For the clip that you guys just saw, which is the introduction of my father, John Lithgow. And we're a very open, loving father and son relationship. We kiss every time we greet each other. And that was the scene they got to see for the first time, which I did. I forgot that we were shooting it that day. And my boys were like, what is going on? I was like, well, is it funny? It's funny, but it's embarrassing. How many more times you guys got to kiss? And I'm like, we'll do it all day long. What? We will do it all day long. Yeah. So they thought it was,
they
were like, Dad, your job's embarrassing.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know one of your kids recently asked you, he's obviously smart to know that this is a thing. He wanted a gap year. He wanted to take a gap year.
Yes. He's in eighth grade.
Okay.
And he said, hey, Dad, I think I want to do a gap year. And I go, between eighth and ninth grade? Like when? Right now? He's like, no, college. I want to do a gap year. I'm like, oh, well, you know, I think that that's something a lot of kids are talking about because, you know, it's hard to really know when you're 17, 18 if what you want to do. And, yeah, if you want to go, you know, get a job or work for the, you know, Peace Corps or do something like that. And he's like, work? No. It's called a gap year, Dad. You just hang out. I'm like, you do not just hang out. You have to do something constructive. He's like, you don't know what you're talking about. It's a gap year. That will be an ongoing argument, I think, in our household.
Well, I hope, I don't know who I'm rooting for, but I hope you guys figure it out. I want to talk to you about this because we've done a very popular segment on our show called Second Chance Theater.
Yes,
so
which I love.
We've done it, I think we've had 605 shows. I think we've done it three times.
Okay.
So it's very popular. There's a sketch of yours that I remember right when I started SNL. It was like a thing that we would all gather around and watch.
As one of the biggest failing sketches at Dress of all time.
It is, when you explain it, it will sound like something that should fail, don't you think?
There's no question.
Yeah.
It's based on, I wrote a sketch about a guy who dresses, looks exactly like Gabe Kaplan, who was the star of the hit sitcom Welcome Back, Kotter.
Yeah.
He was also a professional gambler.
Uh-huh.
Side note. and I wrote a sketch where I worked for an insurance company.
Yeah.
And it took place in a break room. And everyone was, it's the day that Gabe Kaplan came to visit.
The real Gabe Kaplan.
The real Gabe Kaplan. And no one came to get me out of the bathroom to meet him because I was his biggest fan.
Right.
And judging by the silence in this room, you can tell that it didn't work then and it will never work. But that's why we need to bring it back for Second Chance Theater.
Well, here's the thing about it, because the interesting thing is you realize the core problem with the sketch is that no one, there's a lack of recognition for Gabe Kaplan right off the jump. And now it's been 17 years.
Super obscure late 70s reference.
Yeah, and so now time has passed. You would argue that if anything, he's less known.
Less relevant.
But you'd be willing to come and do the Gabe Kaplan sketch.
I would in a heartbeat.
And yeah. I say the reason it was great to watch and why we all watched it is you never waned at all.
Right.
You committed fully.
I had a tendency for some reason when I could tell when a sketch was tanking and I could tell the audience was like, let's just get to the next thing, I would take twice as long.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I wanted to punish the audience. It was like, okay, you don't think it's funny, now you're gonna really not think it's funny, because I'm gonna turn this 3-minute gem into a 8-minute turd, and you're gonna have to sit through it.
And most of the dialogue is you saying to Horatio, John Goodman,
John Goodman, I believe, and Molly and Tim Meadows, maybe.
It's just a lot, you just keep repeating, what?
What? Why wouldn't you come get me? My life is all about Gabe Kaplan.
Next time you're here, we're gonna gonna break out the Kaplan mask and go to work. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for being on at 118.
I love it.
Will Ferrell, everybody, Daddy's Home Channel from Fear Friday.
Hey, everybody. This is Kevin, one of the producers here at Late Night. I had the chance to talk to Will Ferrell for a few minutes in his dressing room after his interview with Seth just for this podcast. So here is our conversation.
No, you don't want to hear my voice.
I want to bring Jimmy Miller into this podcast.
We're sitting here with Jimmy Miller. Yeah.
There's Jimmy Miller.
This is where I clam up.
One of the legendary Hollywood managers, Jimmy Miller.
That's right.
Are we rolling right now?
Oh, yeah. We're always rolling.
Hey,
yeah.
We're back with Will Ferrell backstage here.
There's quite a ruckus out there, isn't there?
Kevin? Yeah, it's that post-Hillary
post-Hillary
noise.
It was quite a buzz in the audience.
That's right.
Man, that was a huge
ovation.
Am I allowed to just jump in?
Yeah.
That was, people were really excited to see her. And who says she doesn't have a sense of humor? She's so funny out there.
Yeah, she's
frustrating.
We need to see more of that.
Right. Well.
Anyway.
Yeah, next time you're back, we'll make sure that she's back too.
I wish I knew she was on the show.
Yeah, you never got that.
I was the second guest, and I never knew it the whole time. Not,
I guess that's our fault for not letting you know.
No, not at all. I looked at all the paperwork. It clearly stated you are second guest to Hillary. I just ignored it.
Yeah.
And so much to, I was about to say dismay. Not really.
Yeah.
I'm still happy to be on the show.
Yeah. No, we're thrilled you're still here.
Yeah.
You didn't...
I was
just up and walk out.
It was a half second where I was going to walk.
Great. I'm glad it all worked out okay. Yeah. So congrats on the movie. We were talking before you went on. There were a couple other stories that you had about shooting this that I thought were fun to talk about. One, you shot in Boston. Your wife grew up outside of Boston.
Yes, in Needham.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot the movie in spring, and it coincided with our kids' spring break. Mm-hmm. So it was a fun opportunity for Viv to bring the boys out and see her mother. The only catch was her mom kind of insists that we stay with her, which means literally sleeping in her childhood bedroom, even though I had a very spacious suite at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. So for 5 nights, I slept in a queen-size bed facing a cold wall. I literally have to, I face a wall because my wife and I are very tall people. And I would just wake up at 5 a.m. and have the car pick me up in Needham, regardless of where we were shooting in the major Boston metropolitan area.
Gotcha. Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you guys shot all around that area. You were saying that you shot in
Manchester by the sea, which, you know, based on that movie, you have this grim, bleak picture of Manchester by the Sea, and it is the most idyllic little town you've ever been to.
Right.
We all went and got shakes at the Shake Shack for lunch. All these little kids, like, waving to us, getting out early from school, and I want to live at Manchester by the Sea. Great little harbor there.
Yeah, people should see that movie.
People should
they
see
decide to move there.
People should see our movie.
Right.
Well, at the beginning of our movie starts with a beauty shot of Manchester by the Sea, but we don't say it's Manchester by the Sea.
Nothing's on fire
because we're any town USA in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing's on fire.
Yeah.
In our movie. Wait, was there a fire in Manchester by the Sea movie?
Oh yeah, I think that was a big Yeah. Okay. Big part of it. From what I gleaned from watching that movie,
yeah,
there was.
There was? Okay.
Yeah. You have such a popular movie with Elf around Christmas. This is another Christmas movie you're doing. Do your kids, what, do you show them that? Or if it's on television at all, like around the holidays like this, do they watch that at all? Are they familiar?
They are. If they were here, if you were to ask them that question, they would probably very politely say, yes, no, it's very good. No, he did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's as if I did a very workmanlike performance. Mm-hmm. You know, the movie that kids and families universally kind of go nuts for,
yeah,
and talk about how it's a perennial, you know, kind of favorite in their household.
Right.
My boys are nonplussed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You and Seth talked about Second Chance Theater doing your gay Kaplan sketch.
Yeah.
Are there any other sketches that you sort of remember?
There was
either,
Seth and I were talking during the commercial break. There was another sketch I distinctly remember that I wrote with Matt Piedmont.
Uh-huh.
I remember Matt Piedmont on the show. And Mike Myers was the host. And we were just two guys on a park bench. And I was playing a heavyset guy who had trouble catching his breath. That was the comedic premise. And so I start to tell a story. I go, hold on, let me catch my breath. Anyway, and then I would go into spinning a yarn of just some weird, complicated, sordid tale. And then right at the climax point of the story, I go, hold on, let me catch my breath. And it played to such crickets.
Uh-huh.
And I could feel Mike Myers' nervous energy of like, why are we taking so long? Because as I explained on the show tonight, my impulse was to slow things down if they were going badly. Where human nature is to speed up and get out of there.
Yeah,
I just said, nope, we're gonna make these beats last even longer.
Yeah.
So that was one. Molly Shannon, her first try at her joyologist character.
Mm-hmm.
She was a talk show host,
mm-hmm,
and I was her sidekick who wore a button that said, ask me how I lost 50 pounds. And that was crickets as well, until I think whatever writer was that figured out, oh no, Molly should be the guest,
uh-huh,
as the joyologist. And all my only line would be like, ask me how I lost 50 pounds. That's all. I was her Ed McMahon to her joy. And I would only say,
oh my gosh.
That was crickets too.
Uh-huh.
How did you lose the 50 pounds?
We never got into it. I would just say it over and over again. And then there was another sketch that Chris Kattan and I wrote where we would hug each other too long.
Uh-huh.
And we talk about the appropriate length of a hug.
Mm-hmm.
And that was crickets too. Those are four powerhouses.
Those are great. I mean, I feel like every time you come back now, we can mount one of those.
We've got four.
And, yeah. Got them in the chamber.
Is Second Chance Theater?
Second Chance Theater. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're set to go. Well, great. Will, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Kevin.
And everybody go see the movie on Friday?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Will.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Once upon a beat!
Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.